Okay, let me, there we go, we should be recording. Okay, today is Tuesday, June 30th, 2009. My name is Amy Schindler, and I'm here with Professor Satoshi Ito for this oral history interview. So we'll just begin, Professor Ito. If you would tell us about your early life, maybe your childhood to begin with, where did you grow up, your family, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my early life is unusual in terms of where most Americans are. At the same time, it's one that has come around over the last 20 years or so when I became interested in contemporary immigration. And so, in a sense, I've had the opportunity, in effect, to use my early life in an empathetic way to try to understand the situation among young immigrants to this country, or to many Americans born to immigrant parents from Latin America, from Asia, from Africa, Caribbean, wherever. And later, what I did was for Christopher Wren Association, I taught a course entitled Contemporary Immigrants. And it kind of built on another course I developed, and we'll talk about that later, Becoming Americans. I think there's some constant elements of East Asian culture that endures, and so even though I was in my 60s and 50s, 60s and 70s, as I talked about contemporary immigrants from different places, including East Asia, I think I was able to emphasize, particularly with the East Asians and the South Asians who immigrate, and their children born here or coming here as youngsters under the age of 10, they are the most likely to find it easy to become assimilated into American culture. My parents were unusual in their origins at their marriage, because they were my mother was a picture bride. My father was a farm laborer here in the United States, having come to the United States from Japan when he was 13 years old. And by this time, when he asked my mother for her hand in marriage, this was 1936, he was 30 years old. And my mother was 19 years old. That 10-year age difference is something, interestingly, that I find in among immigrants coming to the United States from certain parts of the world still. So there's a kind of parallelism there. My mother was born in the state of Idaho, and she and her family stayed there until she was 5 years old. My parents made a decision, her parents made a decision to take all four of their children now, the eldest born in Japan, my mother, and two younger siblings born in Idaho. They returned to Japan because my grandparents thought that the education system in Japan was superior to that in the United States. But it's also a reason why, as a U.S. citizen, my mother was able to return to the United States to marry my father. My mother was a high school graduate, which was relatively unusual in those days. But when she came to the United States, she was non-English speaking and basically is still non-English speaking at age 92. My father picked up Pidgin English, I suppose. But that made it difficult in terms of transmitting Japanese culture to the American-born kids, including myself. December 1941, of course, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And then a few months later, in February, President Roosevelt made the decision that all persons of Japanese ancestry, 70% of them born in the United States, 30% born in Japan. However, all of them within 100 miles of the Pacific coast in California, Oregon, and Washington State had to first go to temporary places and then eventually to these relocation camps. Our family in 1942 shared a horse stall at Santa Anita Racetrack, made famous by Seabiscuit. And then when the basically army barracks were ready in 10 different locations west of the Mississippi River, based on what part of the West Coast one family came from, they were assigned to various places in California, Montana, Arizona, Utah, and so on. We wound up in Roa, Arkansas, which is about 20 miles from the Mississippi River, a very poor part of the state. And as I look back, although the educational system, and I began, you know, my first, second, third grades while we were in camp, as we called it, and the curriculum was American, there was a lot of American culture that was outside, literally outside of our experiences. You know, I didn't read a daily newspaper, didn't hear the daily news or radio and so on, so I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what the fashions, what the popular culture of the times were and so on. And so, in the years that have passed since, I still feel a little lost because I can't recapture what I didn't experience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people of my generation would say, do you remember such and such and such? Well, no. Mm-hmm. Okay. It took a while for transportation and temporary housing to get arranged again. Mm-hmm. So we didn't leave Arkansas until November of 1945. And then we were taught that one of the striking things I remember my father saying is to try to pass ourselves off as Chinese. And that was done to protect us from discrimination against Japs. Mm-hmm. You know. And my parents went back to being farm laborers. 1948 was a critical time in my life for several reasons. One, I finally lived in a place that was reasonably normal for a residential area in Southern California. Mm-hmm. That was the first time in my life that we had indoor plumbing. First time in my life that I lived in a house that's actually painted on the outside. But I think because of the emphasis that my parents and other Japanese parents had of their children, the expectations were that, you know, my mother used to say, don't be a dumb farmer like me, like us, okay? And so one thing that a lot of folks, when they talk about immigration today also, is that what they do is they transfer the inability of the immigrant parents, especially those with non-English speaking mm-hmm. abilities and those who haven't assimilated into mm-hmm. American culture, to assume that their kids are going to be the same. What they don't appreciate is that sometimes, as in the case of my parents, my mother especially, they set themselves up as negative reference persons. Mm-hmm. Don't be like us. Right. You're here in the United States. You need to do well in school. You need to prepare yourself to get a good job when you get out into the larger society. And so, as a whole, I think we're like the Jews. Given our native abilities, I think we've, as a group, have overachieved. Okay. Let's see what else.
When you say we, do you mean Japanese Americans?
Yeah, Japanese Americans.
Or immigrants?
Japanese Americans. Mm-hmm. And then I would extend that to today's immigrants, young. Mm-hmm. Young immigrants and children born mm-hmm. to immigrants here in the United States from East Asia, from some parts of the Middle East, and from South Asia, from Africa, mm-hmm. from the Caribbean, from many places around the world. I mean, you know, what you see is an overrepresentation of, I think, outstanding students mm-hmm. coming out of our high schools and colleges mm-hmm. of immigrant backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I think that's important about me is that my parents lived in a community in Southern California that was largely white with a sizable number of Mexican Americans. And so I was relatively early to assimilate into white middle class culture. Mm-hmm. And because I did well in school, those were my friends, mm-hmm. the better students. Because I came from a relatively poor family, it had a very important bearing on how I started college. Mm-hmm. I started at the local community college, El Camino College. Went there for 2 years. Went there because it was affordable. $2.50 a semester to pay for paper. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then went from there to Long Beach State. And then did well enough there to be admitted into three places that I applied to for graduate school. University of Washington, Seattle, and University of Wisconsin, Madison, and UNC Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. Went to, and I got a little bit of money from UCH, but a full assistantship from UNC, and that's where I went.
Going back a little bit, at what point in your education did you have an idea of what you wanted to do after college?
Okay, when I was a sophomore in high school, we took one of these vocational tests, mm-hmm. and at that time I was targeted to become a CPA.
Those are great tests. It's always great to find out.
Bookish and quantitative, you know. Some of that carried over into college. When I was a sophomore at El Camino College, I became interested in cultural anthropology and sociology, and that's what I basically wound up majoring in. When I got, and that's my bachelor's degree, master's, and PhD are all in sociology. It was personally relevant to me because as I looked around and I was always consciously, I think, trying to see where I fit in the scheme of things. As I progressed at Chapel Hill in graduate school, you know, what most people did in those days when they graduated, got their PhDs, was to teach in college. And so after a second year, that I basically saw myself as teaching at some institution of higher learning. Mm-hmm. Because of the language problem between us and my parents, I think we just each missed out on a lot. Mm-hmm. There's not a whole lot, really, of Japanese culture and Japanese language that any of us four kids received, because it was what they could communicate in broken English, so to speak, in very elementary Japanese. Mm-hmm. And our conversations and response were in broken Japanese. And so we never got to the point where there was anything that was intellectual and cultural that we talked about. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we were a strong family all along. Mm-hmm. But in terms of cultural content, I think there was a lot that was missing. And that may be something that other immigrant families also experience. And in my case, to the point of negating that which was part of Japanese and Japanese American culture, I remember at Long Beach State, I was getting toward the into the second semester of my senior year, and there was a guy, you know, there were a group of Japanese American students walking by, and they said, "Come and have a picture taken with us. You know, this is for the college annual, the Japanese American club." Mm-hmm. And I just said no, and they would say, "But you're a Buddha head." You know, and I just didn't. So from relatively early on, I was pretty highly assimilated. It's relevant to something that's personal that's going to come up in October. In October, my wife and I are going to Japan. I went there for a faculty seminar in November, Thanksgiving week in 1993. 1 week, and basically in Tokyo. But it was an exposure to Japan. Mm-hmm. And this time what I tried to do is I tried to contact Japanese relatives living in Japan on my father's side.
Okay.
Because I hadn't been in very much contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's side, I was really fortunate because my mother's older brother, who was born in Japan, but trilingual in English, Japanese, mm-hmm. and Russian, he and I corresponded for about 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
We could write letters to each other.
Mm-hmm.
In English, you know. And the strange thing is I was closer to him, a man that I hadn't seen until 1993, as compared with my father's older brother who was living in Los Angeles, my mother's younger brother living only two doors down from us in Gardena. So, kind of weird. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
I got in contact with somebody who would be at the grandchild generation of my father in Japan. Fortunately, he emails and he writes in English.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, in connection with, he was sending messages of grievance for my brother's passing. And then he just incidentally almost said, I would be happy to serve as a guide if you ever come to Japan. And I took him up on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so while we're in Kyoto, we have a day and a half. And Yokkaichi is, you know, I went to Google and all that. I found that Yokkaichi, where my father was born and where this fellow and his family still live, is 50 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's going to do is he's going to drive his car, pick us up in Kyoto, take us back to his home in Yokkaichi, and show us around.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process, because that family has visited California,
okay.
to visit, but see, I wasn't there at that time,
right.
so I got missed it. Except one thing I did intentionally in March, when I went to California, was I ransacked one trunk and three suitcases of photographs at my mother's place. And with the intention of developing a small album,
mm-hmm.
but on our family in the United States,
mm-hmm.
to take and present to this fellow I'm going to meet,
mm-hmm.
in October. So. You know, small world, and it just takes some daring and, you know, to pull something like that off,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Finding the right connection.
Yeah.
Yeah, happenstance.
And sometimes what sociologists call, like these loose connections,
mm-hmm.
sometimes as loose as they are, sometimes they can take, and that's what I hope will happen this time.
Ready to switch gears a little bit,
sure.
and talk about your William Mary phase of life a bit.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you would, just tell us about your decision to accept the position,
okay.
at William Mary, how
yeah.
that came about.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just tie this on. Tie this in with what I mentioned about my parents.
Okay.
As you might guess, they had relatively little to do with which graduate school I went
mm-hmm.
to or what I did after finishing graduate school,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so there weren't any kinds of pressures or anything like that happening there. So it's largely personal. At that time, and one of the things that I'm always self-analyzing, and I said, why am I this way or that way,
mm-hmm.
now and then. Okay, going back to 1965, you know, I'm leaving Chapel Hill,
mm-hmm.
looking for a job. Looking back, I think I was fortunate to have been born during the Depression in 1937, because during the 1930s, not very many people were born.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what happened 1965. By 1965, the baby boomers were just starting to come into our colleges and universities, which meant that colleges and universities were desperate to find faculty. Mm-hmm. And so I was in a situation that many would find incredible today. You know, what? Yes. Not only did you find one position, but two positions mm-hmm. offered you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. And so, the first position was one from a reputable institution in Texas. Mm-hmm. But I came here for an interview after that and received the offer from College William & Mary before I had to respond to the other. Okay, knowing more about William & Mary's reputation and so on, overall, even though it was a little bit less money, mm-hmm. I came to William & Mary.
Mm-hmm. Was there also the familiarity of, you'd been at UNC, which is only a few years away,
you'd
been to Texas?
That was part of it. Another important part of it was that there were two people who were UNC PhDs in the department.
Mm-hmm. Here at William & Mary?
Yeah. Okay. No, three. There were three. In fact, one of them was, I was in graduate school. So that made a personal pull to William & Mary stronger. Then the other thing I think I need to say, and it's one of those generational things. I think hiring practices were more informal in those days.
Yes.
We didn't have personnel committees and things like that. We didn't have applications that had to pass through a number of different hands.
Right.
Committee reviews and all that,
mm-hmm.
and so I think it also helped me.
They knew you, that personal connection,
yeah,
of people here already knew you.
Okay.
So when you arrived on campus, what do you remember about maybe that first year on campus?
Yeah, okay. I have the benefit of hindsight,
mm-hmm.
so I know,
yes,
what was different then as compared with now. It was a happy time. It was a happy time because we saw each other as one faculty. You know, we had business and education and arts and sciences,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes in the same building. And we used to go to what is now the Wigwam and have coffee,
mm-hmm.
and we had an informal faculty club and so forth, and there were opportunities to meet people representing the campus as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now physically, of course, the law school was still separated then, but we knew a few people in law school too, so that was very very different. We were a smaller school, with 2,000 undergraduate students,
mm-hmm.
et cetera, that made it different. But it was, for me personally, it was a good time to come in because in the late 60s and into the 70s, the college grew and its programs grew.
Mm-hmm.
And it was reflected in things like the Department of Education becoming the School of Education, Business Administration becoming the School of Administration. And then 1968, Sociology Department started an MA program,
mm-hmm.
And so we kind of were excited in feeling that, hey, maybe someday we'll grow up and become a university,
First moved to Williamsburg, where did you live?
Oh, good question. I was single and Wayne Kernodle, the chair of the department at that time, said, well, we can find you an apartment at what is now Eastern State mm-hmm. Hospital. And Eastern State Hospital, remember at that time, during mid-60s, was still a large state mental facility mm-hmm. with a large population, both in terms of number of clients and the staff. Mm-hmm. And there were dormitories and there were apartments there at Eastern State. Eastern State eventually became, that part became a part of the College of William & Mary. Mm-hmm. And so it was in that transition period. Anyway, I found a nice apartment there. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to a regular apartment in town. Okay. My assimilationist tendencies came out in the selection of my first wife. She was a white woman. This at a time when the campus was overwhelmingly white, mm-hmm. both in terms of faculty, staff, and students. And there weren't very many Asian Americans. And so, and I had been comfortable all along, especially since high school, being around white people. Mm-hmm. Out of class of 309 graduating seniors from Luzinger High School, Francis Ninokawa and myself, we were the only Japanese Americans out of 309, you see. And so, you know, a lot of my friends, most of my friends were whites. In college, same way. At the University of North Carolina, the same way, and then, of course, on campus. One interesting thing that is related to William & Mary in the mid-1960s was that, as a whole, it was such a segregated institution. And I'm going to anticipate a little bit of some of my post retirement year activities, and that's working with the Anti-Racism Commission of the Diocese of Southern Virginia Episcopal Church. And I do quite a bit of teaching of clergy and of lay leaders, mm-hmm. vestry members, that kind of thing. last Thursday, I was involved in training camp counselors at Chanco, all these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And we talk about institutional racism, et cetera. And it didn't hit me until I got involved with this training and so forth, mm-hmm. that how one can be an unintended racist. Mm-hmm. You see, because what I saw myself at that time, I was kind of innocent, and I just, had a job, taught mm-hmm. these classes, right. and so forth. And it wasn't until, the last 10 years that I came to see myself in 1965 and late 60s as kind of an unintended racist, mm-hmm. because I was a part of an institution that was intentionally racist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You see? And so, and I use that as an example at times to point out ways in which we can be racist without intending to be. You know, you, in effect, you're going along because you're a participant. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Oh yeah, okay. And let me just go on another theme. I'm sorry. Another theme, I talked about 1968 and starting the MA program and how, along with other colleges and other departments, we began to see ourselves as doing something, in quotes, more important. We're teaching people who are college graduates, getting their master's degrees and some departments, PhDs and so forth. So for me, it became kind of an intellectual challenge.
Sure.
And we were rigorous because we were simply part of arts and sciences. So we had things like comprehensive exams, mm-hmm. you know, for our students. We had a thesis requirement. Mm-hmm. These continue. And so we viewed ourselves as doing something important, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then eventually, one of the things academically for the Department of Sociology, maybe the most important thing I did was to be the chair of the graduate program and in sociology,
mm-hmm.
MA program in sociology. There were three of us, I can name names. Gary Cripps, David Aday, and myself. We're still good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have kind of a special attraction to each other, still after all these years.
Mm-hmm.
Because we worked disproportionately with so many other graduate students. And it became kind of incestuous because we would serve on each other's,
sure.
you know, thesis committees and examination committees and things of that sort. And it was gratifying to do that. I developed a graduate level course in sociological theory, and I think that was one of the most satisfying things I did.
Thinking about going back to the formation of the MA program in
yeah.
sociology, do you have any memories of that as being particularly difficult, or was it very perfunctory as far as the formation and getting it off the ground?
Yeah, always. I think for William Mary in general, a problem has been, you know, can we compete in terms of our stipends given to graduate students as compared with other places? You know, and we had that problem within the Department of Sociology.
Mm-hmm. So it's nothing new. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. We felt that we did a good job. We had something that sounds very snobbish, and we used to say that we turn what is it, sow's ears into, you know, purses or something like
yeah.
that. We're proud that we have a number of our MA students who've gone to University of Massachusetts, Arizona, and Cal Berkeley and other places, and they're out there with PhDs, and of course they're older now, so some of them are retired,
yeah.
But it's satisfying.
Yeah.